Five, four, three, two, one.
What's the situation, Captain?
This is Situation Fluxus, a weekly one-hour program focused on jazz and improvised music, news, radio, conversations, and more. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. There'll be no news this week. I just let the tape roll as I interviewed my guests for today's show. My guests are Canadians, composer, cellist, curator, writer, and founder and publicist for Riparian Media, Nick Storing, and Portugal native cellist, Marina Hasselberg. Her October release on Redshift Records is titled Red. Guest improvisers are Giorgio Magnanesi on electronics, Jesse Zubot on violins and acting as producer of this release, Aram Bajentian on guitar, and Kenton Lowen on drums. So I want to thank you both for joining me here on Situation Fluxus.
Thank you for having us.
So in what roles did you two begin working on Red? Why don't we start with Nick?
Well, why don't we actually start with Marina, because the project started long before I was involved. That's okay.
Yeah, of course. So it's been a kind of a long project already. I guess the beginnings of it probably around 2017, when I first decided I want to do this and applying for grants, and took a long time. So then the pandemic, and also the recording was actually recorded in 2020. So the album was recorded in 2020. So it's been a very rich but very long process. So Nick came into the project more recently, so in this last year, I believe, and that's when I started thinking about what to do moving forward when the music started getting ready, and I was looking for a publicist. And now I knew Nick as a cellist, because the album is mostly a cello album, we guessed as well, but mostly a cello album. I thought Nick would most likely be the ideal person for this. First of all, we live in the same country, different coasts, so quite far from each other, in fact, but with, in a way, a similar background and part of similar scenes, so experimental music, improvisation, cello, strings. And so I couldn't think of a better person. And I did not know Nick was a publicist. I knew him as a musician, but it was actually the label, so Redshift label, that's going to release the record, that recommended Nick, because they had worked with Nick before, and they had only great things to say about his work. And so that's how it started. It was like, oh, I know Nick, and that was it. So I contacted Nick, and he was fantastic. He said he was very, very busy, but would like to be a part of it. And so that's what happened. So that's my side of the story.
Nick, is she telling the truth?
Yes, that's all fairly accurate. Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what to say in response to this question in terms of my own role entering into it. I mean, I've been doing, as Marina mentioned, I'm cello is my main instrument. I'm also a composer, and I've been doing the publicity thing for the last about the last 4 years. But I sort of started doing it a little bit before that with some smaller projects and like my own work, of course. Like I was sort of always involved publicizing my own music, even when there were like other publicists involved and stuff. So yeah, that sort of sums up my sort of involvement in it. I don't know if you wanted something to hear something different from me on that topic, but
I just want to hear your truth. I'm good with that. I'm good. Yeah. Producing music isn't like producing cookies. You know, once those delicious little babies jump into a box, you'll never see them again. And you really don't know what happens to them. You know, were they eaten right away or are they molding in someone's cupboard, right? When you work together as producer and artist or publicist and artist, a relationship is formed. Whether you see or work with each other ever again, something happens for a moment. With Marina's release due out on October 21st, in reflecting on your relationship during the making of Red and now, how would you two explain it?
Mm-hmm. Would you like to start on this one, Nick?
Well, prior to my coming on as a publicist, I felt like we kind of knew each other very peripherally in terms of like being members of the same sort of orbit and scene on a national level. So we'd never met in person. We still haven't. And so, yeah, I knew her more as a sort of colleague that sort of, you know, was sort of operating in a kind of in Vancouver doing similar stuff to me, except that I'm like, she's much more of a performer than I am. Like I'm not really that much of a cellist, to be perfectly honest. It is my primary instrument, and I do perform live, but it's not, I'm not playing repertoire. I'm not, you know, I'm primarily doing things just strictly on my own terms, because I don't have the like level of skill and commitment to do interpretation of other people's work, I guess. So, but I sort of knew Marina as a peer in the music sort of realm more than, you know, anything else. But, you know, now we have this other sort of relationship, and I've kind of delved quite deep into like, you know, her background and everything. And I feel like I've gotten to know her quite a bit better because I had to write, you know, publicity material that, you know, talked about various collaborations, various other projects that she's done. And so that's how that sort of developed. So the relationship it's sort of grown from there. I know a lot more about her, and in the future, that would sort of change the sort of dynamic when I go back to being a musician. You know, if there's a case where someone's asking about a Vancouver cellist, I will have a lot better concept of Marina as a player than I did prior to this.
Marina, go ahead.
So that's actually interesting to hear like Nick's ideas and how like how he sees all this basically connection or relationship, but it makes a lot of sense to me. And as he was sharing these thoughts, I actually thought in a way it's like he had to kind of do a detective work. He was like, who is this person? Because I can tell him a few things about myself, but in a way it's going to be my own vision of what I do and my history. So it's very interesting that he actually did his own research, right? So he went and found out what he needed to find out. So I don't know how many secrets he has now. I don't know to which extent he knows all the things that happened in my life. It's really, really interesting. But yeah, I would in a way I feel similarly about the fact that we knew each other. Again, as I mentioned before, we live in different coasts, which in Canada that means really really far away. I remember once, I think, kind of comparing, because I'm from Portugal in Europe, and that's like would be at least six countries away from each other, right? If we're talking European country size. So there hasn't been a lot of contact for sure. I think we might have met once actually in Vancouver. Nick, did you play for Vancouver New Music or?
Yes, 2015.
Possibly.
So, did you meet there?
I think so. I mean, that's what I had in my mind. I saw you had a cello with you, right?
Yeah. That electric one. This one over there.
Oh, cool! Yes, I remember. Like, you were doing really cool stuff with amplification. I think maybe some feedback ideas too. I don't remember, but it was definitely different from what I was doing at the time. And I remember really connecting to it. I think it was very, very cool.
Yes.
So that might have been the only time we actually were physically in the same space.
Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, we have like probably hundreds of common friends. So it's one of those things, even through social media, your name comes up a lot. So it's very interesting that way. And then in the process, I would say we are probably at the peak of actually our collaboration now. It's not like it has happened, because I did all the work like preparing the album, and now this is the time where Nick joins in actually doing the publicity for this upcoming month until the release date. So most of the work and most of the collaboration is actually happening right now.
Right now.
Yeah, exactly, right now. So it's very interesting because I must say Nick is very patient, was in the past with me, because for me it's very, very tricky to go and like find certain things, send files and share things. And so all that work has been done. And now it's more the fun part where Nick writes back to me. He's like, okay, so and so Cheryl would like to interview us both. And so it's more of a celebration of the project. That's the way I see it. So I feel that this is past the stressful bit, and it's the fun part. It's the fruits of our collaboration that's happening right now. So I am very curious about it. It's the first time I'm going through all of this, because this is my debut album. So I'm learning a lot, but also having fun with this idea of now sharing the music and talking about it. And also finally hearing about what other people have to say about the music too. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting.
Well, on that, Marina, I think connoisseurs of classical music become just as irate as connoisseurs of jazz when an artist crosses that fictitious line that separates what's authentic from what's an aberration.
Exactly.
You know, and heaven forbid if, you know, that artist becomes successful doing it.
Oh.
Do you fend off disparaging remarks from traditional classical music folks about your music?
Well, that is a very interesting question on a pretty complex topic, I think. It's very interesting to observe how different scenes interact, how they form like little borders, and they try to not overlap, and people kind of stick to a certain team. So that is no doubt very interesting. And I agree that some people highly dislike it when an artist does something that doesn't follow certain rules or doesn't fit a certain idea they have of what it should be like. But I think what this album did for me, and I'm actually very happy about that, and this is for me specifically, it's not about what other people will perceive or get from it, but it's my experience, is that for the first time in my life, I was able to disconnect from all of that and just do my thing. So because I've been part of many of those themes, raised in the classical world, let's put it like that, and going to the Baroque music world, actually, so with the Baroque setups, all the traditional and historic performance, and then going into improvisation, free jazz, electronics, looping, all those different scenes, right? And then at the end, what turned out to be is this language that is my language. But for the first time, I didn't feel I had to please anyone. I didn't have to fit in a box. I just went for it. Actually, it was not the plan of the album. The album was supposed to be something completely different. And I remember the morning of the first recording session, talking to the producer and say, showing with him that I had changed my mind.
Wow.
In the studio already. So I had planned what I had thought of this album an album of a lot of acoustic cello, pretty introspective, something you'd listen to when I live alone or have been living alone for many years. So a music that you listen to at home while you are cleaning up, doing the dishes, doing your laundry. So very domestic activities. Mm. You are on your own. There is a space and you listen to this music. That was my initial plan for this album. And possibly because of where I was in my life, when it finally came the time to record it, which was 3 years after the whole idea started, which is a lot of time, at least for a mind like mine, because I keep changing all the time. I remember just feeling I wanted the album to be completely opposite. I wanted it to be honest. I wanted it to be raw. I wanted it to be free. I wanted to not follow any ideas of politeness or again, trying to fit in any box. So yeah, I mentioned that the day of. I mentioned it to the producer, Jesse Zubat, and he was like, okay then. And that's what happened. That's what we built over 3 days. A completely different album.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let me speak with Nick, the cellist and the sound artist. You began using electronic instruments and keyboards as a preteen. You had already been playing cello and composing music. And it seems just like your music, your trajectory has become layered. You became a writer and publicist. You've composed for instruments and dancers. And you now have a new release out titled
Music From Way, it's called.
Music From Way on Orange Music Records.
Orange Milk.
Orange Milk Records. Yes, yes. How do you promote yourself? Who are you first? Publicist, curator, journalist?
Composer.
Yeah. Yeah, many hats that you wear.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's an interesting question because it's changing constantly. Prior to the pandemic, I was definitely sort of inclined to put myself out there as a composer, musician first, and then probably like a write like a journalist second, and then the other stuff was sort of this, you know, other thing. I was taking on the odd publicity project, but it wasn't really until 2020 and 2021 and this year that the publicity stuff really started to accelerate. And now I'm at a point where I'm finding that publicity is sort of almost my full-time job, and then composition is kind of the, it's pretty close there too. I mean, that will never, composition will never sort of, and music making will never kind of fully disappear. I mean, that's just sort of my first, my first passion. But yeah, the publicity thing has really taken off in the last few years, and I'm not writing journalistically quite as much anymore. Mm-hmm. Just because I like to do it, and I would do it if I had more time, but right now it's kind of like I'm doing a lot of the publicity work, some grant writing for clients, and then making music for various things, dance chamber music settings. Like right now I'm working on a sextet for string quartet, accordion, and forte piano. That's going to be done very soon. That's sort of where I'm at now. It's kind of it's changed like dramatically in the last couple of years. Like it's really surprised me how much the publicity end of things has taken off. But during the pandemic, because of the fact that no one was, there weren't live events as much. And in Toronto, that stuff is still sort of lagging behind. Like, you know, recently there's been a boom of events, but there's still venues that had music before that don't. Mm. And there's sort of like this, a lot of question marks, but because of all the recordings coming out, my services became much more in demand, and then word of mouth sort of just made that sort of spread. So, Yeah.
I mean, people, no matter what is happening, people still are creating.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Actually, possibly, I guess, more than now with the pandemic, right? When we are facing all these possibly life-changing events that make us really have to process things through expression, yeah. I think. Yeah.
And respond. You respond to the stress, respond to the danger, respond through music.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I like that part.
Yeah. So we've talked around the release Red. Now let's talk to the release Red, which is, as I said, coming out on October 21st. Going back to where we started with you two, what inspired your work? What inspired your relationship?
Well, I can start if Nick is okay with that. I think it's a little bit of what I already mentioned earlier of Nick, in a way, I think being the ideal person for this project because of his background, because also him living in Canada, because he plays a cello. There are written pieces in this album as well. And Nick being a composer, he understands all that side of things as well. So new music pieces, there's actually a piece that's one of the first pieces ever written for solo cello, the Gabrielli, which I'm sure Nick also knows. So there are a lot of connections that made this collaboration ideal, in my opinion. And so far, I'm extremely happy. I mean, it would be really funny if I said the opposite right now. But
Yes, it would.
Nick has been absolutely fantastic, and I would recommend him to anyone that's looking for a publicist for sure. A very, very easy to work with, very, very pleasant, very professional. A fantastic person to work with. So thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that for me, a lot of, the sort of, I guess, inspiration on my end comes from that sort of shared, that shared kind of aesthetic stuff, like that we're both coming from, like same primary instrument, but also being kind of artists that are kind of in a lot of different worlds simultaneously. Like my own practice sort of, like I have the sort of stuff that I record, and the collaborations with dancers and stuff, and Marina does a lot of sort of collaboration as well. I also did a lot of, I don't do as much of it anymore, but I was really pretty involved in free improvisation in Toronto when I first moved here. And, you know, I still do a lot of that when I can. So there's the improvisational thing. And then also having the sort of classical background. I'm not, like, as I said, I'm not much of a classical performer, but, you know, I definitely trained that way. And, you know, I'm involved in that, the contemporary music scene as a composer. And in fact, I know like where I studied, where I did my undergrad, that's like Linda Catlin Smith, who's on the album, taught there. She wasn't my teacher personally, but
that's so fantastic. I didn't realize that connection.
Yeah, no. So I've known Linda for like that, you know, more than 20 years.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
that is fantastic. Yeah.
So, and she's been really instrumental in actually like helping launch my own career. Like, she's been really helpful in making connections here in Toronto. So she's fantastic. So, I mean, I feel like I really gravitated toward this project personally because there's sort of personal connections. There's, you know, this kind of sense of like blending a whole bunch of different experimental music things. And that sort of embodies the spirit of what I like to do as an artist and as a writer and curator and publicist. Like the people that I sort of support as a publicist, they range from kind of like people doing kind of ambient stuff to like, you know, even sort of classical, like Common Practice era classical stuff. I've even done stuff for a harpist who does traditional Irish music. So it's like, I guess there's this sort of, you know, this eclecticism, but, you know, music that's geared toward listening, I guess, is sort of where my head's at. So this album really spoke to that and combined a lot of different elements. I really like that. So, yeah.
My interview with Marina Hasselberg and Nick Storing, with music performed by both. For more information about Marina Hasselberg, marinahasselberg.com. And for more information about Nick Storing, nickstoring.ca.
Something that I found intriguing about what you said about, you were talking about the sort of the issue that people have with like crossing genres with like especially classical and jazz, like but something I've actually found like and been very like pleasantly surprised about in the last few years as I've sort of started to do more of this like publicity research is that there is like I feel like there are sites and like in places where this stuff is like speaking to each other more, actually more on the jazz side than the classical side. Like if you look at, there's a lot of like reviewers on All About Jazz and like some other kind of pretty visible like sites online where there's a lot of like crossover happening. Like even Free Jazz Blog does a lot of kind of coverage of non, you know, like non-free jazz things. But there's quite a few reviewers on All About Jazz, and I'm trying to think of there's other examples too, and there's also reviewers that really that's their main thing. There's like, you know, like Andy Hamilton, who writes for The Wire and Jazz Journal, that those are his two things, like classical contemporary music and jazz. And so I was really heartened but actually to find this that people are kind of that people are starting to see that kind of connection, because I think it's really, I don't see the world that way. I find it strange that there's this kind of these sharp divisions between, or in these sharp allegiances to like separate musical worlds. Like when, you know, on the experimental end of things, people have a very common goal. Like I've just always found that so strange, and it never made sense to me because I like my listening is all over the place. So it's nice to see that there is more of that, you know, integration of those two realms, or like multiple realms, not even just those two. And that's sort of an indication of where things are headed, because I think it's good for everyone to like to learn from one another and to combine and to sort of share knowledge and stuff.
Oops.
You're listening to Situation Fluxus on WGXC, 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I'm your host, Cheryl Kay. Please send your comments, quips, and anecdotes, as well as feedback to thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com. For more information about the show, jazzfluxus.com. My interview was with sound artist, composer, and improviser Norman W. Long. So I'd like to thank you for joining me here on Situation Fluxus.
Thank you.
Yeah. In a Bandcamp article from February of this year, you were interviewed and profiled by Erin Margaret Day. It seems you've partially come full circle, now having at your disposal more of the materials to record and perform that you either couldn't afford or that were not introduced to you while attending the San Francisco Art Institute 25 plus years ago. With the materials that you're utilizing now, what is your present project and what is its focus?
All right. So the project I'm working on is called Calumet in Dub. It collects sounds, field recordings, sonified data from the Lake Calumet region and areas on the Little Calumet River. It entails a collection of data sets on demographics, ecology, and pollution. The areas that I recorded from are from public parks and from my own sort of living space as well, including a lot of new parks that have come up since the 2010s, like Big Marsh, Indian Ridge Marsh, and Steelworkers Park. Those particular areas are interesting because they were heavily polluted sites along not only the Calumet area, but the Calumet area is also part of the Great Lakes Rust Belt area as well. So there are many steel mills that had popped up around there since the 1850s. And since the 1850s, not only has there been pollution like slag and metal waste, but also waste from dredging up the lake and to fill in some of the marshland areas for residents, for, you know, building particular communities around these areas. So a lot of these parks, those parks in particular, are filled with basically waste product from the steel mills called slag. And over the last, I would say maybe 20 years, there's been an effort to remediate the soil, get rid of some of this waste, and let the ecology come through and to recover a little bit. Well, it's not going to be the same as pre-Columbian days or the same as when it was home to the Illinois, Potawatomi, and Miami peoples. But it's something that we can still see a recovery from. And you can see plants coming in, native plants, seeing, having it still be a migratory path for birds and a haven for other small animals and insects. And the other part of it is that these bodies of water are also part of a migration and then part of the great migration of
African Americans, former enslaved peoples, since probably the mid-1800s. I thought that was interesting, as a little Calumet River was part of the Underground Railroad, where some folks stopped at that point and made their and settled in the area along the Little Calumet, or they moved further to Detroit or even to Canada. So I thought that was a very interesting combination of facts where we see change, where I'm sort of like mapping out and sonifying and doing this sort of eight channel composition about change, to make it kind of simple.
Yeah. Well, later in your academic life, you studied at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York.
Yes.
And while studying at Cornell, you developed an emotional and theoretical connection with agriculture and green spaces. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Yes, a larger awareness of ecology and even what we call soundscapes. Yes, yes.
Yeah. Now, you were born on the south side of Chicago, Illinois, and you presently live south of Chicago. You've been there about 16 years or so.
What? Yes.
Yeah. What do you better understand about your present community and your surrounding environs after living and studying elsewhere?
Wow, what a interesting question. I think, well, right now, I'm staying on the southeast side of Chicago, where I was born and raised. And what I think, well, there's one thing that I was absolutely made aware of that was quite, it was really right under my nose. And it's now called Marion R. Burns Park. Before then, it was this open space, sort of the, like this open prairie, two blocks from my house. Now, when I was a kid, I wasn't much, I was out, I would say I was, not too much of an outdoors kid, but when I had friends to play with and stuff like that, I'll always be out, maybe we'd be playing, I don't know, catch or something like that, but I didn't really explore much around my area, particularly prairies and stuff, the prairie along that way. Some of my friends did, and they, I don't know, they just ran around chasing snakes and frogs. And I thought, oh, that's, I didn't find that interesting. But I didn't understand that that was a place where our neighbor, Mrs. Burns, fought to keep from being a huge parking lot for the transportation agency, the public transportation agency here called the CTA. I had no idea that, it was made for, maybe the kids to explore a little bit. Now, this was an open space, not so much of a park like it is now with walking paths, but just kind of like a wild area that, people were not supposed to touch, you were not supposed to dump there, not supposed to build there. Very interesting. So I found that out at sort of like at a social sort of for the College of Art, Architecture and Planning at Cornell. And I saw a documentary about Mrs. Burns, and I was like, recognized her house, recognized the lady. And it was basically about that, how she had involved herself with saving that piece of land. And I had no idea. And so since every once in a while I'd go there before it was, I started recording there around 2015, 2016, didn't have much time. I was working at a local nonprofit at the time. So, but yeah, I thought that was, I think that was like probably like the most significant thing that I learned about the community. And then it inspired me to do more field recordings, which is just recordings. If people aren't familiar with the term field, it's just any recording that's outside the studio.
I'd like to ask you about your work, CECON 1 through 3 from 2021. It was inspired by printmaker Belkis Aeon.
Yes, I believe that's how you say it.
I believe so too. She specialized in calligraphy. She committed suicide in 1999. Oh. What did you discover and take from her art, her life, and her death?
I found her work to be both magical and layered, and I don't know how else to say it, but those two things come to mind first. What was really interesting was how I was able to be introduced to the work. It was through Honeypot Performance, and that is a collective of Black feminist women in the Chicago area whose work really deals with community and culture, and in particular cultures around Chicago and South Chicago, then the South Side of Chicago. And a lot of their interest, you know, focuses on, for instance, highlighting or centering on something like the work of a Black woman from Cuba. So that was sort of the vibe that they had. And so I was very interested in the print. And also with this origin story, it was the origin story that wasn't, that she was not meant to know about, because however, or part of a legacy that she wasn't included in, because she went to meetings and she had worked with, I don't say work with, but sort of somewhat of a observer of the Abukwa secret society, which is only male, and it focused on, however, is male, but it was focused on this myth of this woman who, I don't know how to say this, kind of like gained knowledge and agency, but in a certain way was punished for it at the end. But how I saw the story and how I composed it was that Sikan's end, or that legend, just sort of looped back, because it was becoming a new beginning of a new idea of, I don't know, just can't, I'm just thinking of something that didn't end because of knowledge. What if that knowledge was, gained a higher self? So it was part of sort of like this condemnation, this was this birth, this sort of condemnation and this rebirth that came from part 1, 2, and 3. This is just something that just, I feel like, yeah, I know it's been a little bit more than a year that I, you know, finished the piece, but that was something I wanted to do, is like birth, death, and rebirth. I felt like there was like that particular part of the myth. And also I wanted to link some of the field recordings that, you know, local field recordings, but also sort of sounds of the Mbera, some particular beats that were sort of more Afro-Cuban, and sort of just sort of like kind of like building it into sort of like a mantra or a soundscape that also references, you know, the house music that, you know, we in the group love so much. Yeah. So that's sort of the idea that that even though she's gone and died in, you know, such a tragic way, that maybe us centering on, you know, the kind of like creativity from a Black woman can be celebrated, even though if it wasn't before she passed. I believe she had, the people that knew her work loved her work, so it wasn't like she was completely unknown or anything, but it was just something that I was glad to be part of, you know, this sort of centering.
You're very candid about your experience at the Institute in the article. Feelings of loneliness, depression, anxiety, and rage. What memories or feelings do you find yourself revisiting to inform your music, your artwork, and your performances?
Well, I think that, I guess I have two minds of it. One where I want a feeling of not something that is an uncontrollable rage or uncontrollable sort of like emotion, but something that is sort of sustained. It would be sort of like a joy or a peace or a way for me to, when I think about or when I'm approaching my work, I try to come at it from a way that I can't say it's not emotional, but whatever it is, it's, you know, I'm acknowledging whatever that sadness or I'm responding to. I think my work is probably a response to some of my negative feelings, whether specifically, and I'm sure you've heard a lot of this from maybe some other artists too during the pandemic, that for me, it was, you know, this feeling of uncertainty, this feeling of anger, particularly not only because of this fear of the unknown or fear of getting sick, and this was before the vaccines were available. I had that sort of feeling of, oh, I don't want to be out, I don't want to do this. And then around May, we had this George Floyd, these uprisings, and I would like to say a shift of consciousness, but maybe that's too good of a word for it. But like there was an awareness of what was going on with Black folks and the police, and particular violence that's been going, you know, that's been happening for years. So those things kept me, for the pieces that I've been doing since 2020, especially during my practice of walking and listening and also doing a form of walking meditation, I was able to gain a better sense of self in place and have that particular rage or uncertainty sort of like just sort of wash away while I'm walking, which is a lot of what, you know, some people would it's sort of, it's like a system of self-care in a way. And so that's one way I dealt with it. Another way was to think about and sort of reaffirm who I am as an artist, as a Black man, as someone living in, you know, an urban area, and thinking about some of those limitations that we talked about of, you know, maybe lack of resources, or whether it's, you know, mentors or particular, you know, mentors or something that's monetary. Yeah, I came from that sort of background and it influenced my aesthetic, influenced the way I play music and explore sound. And I want to take that sort of lack that I felt that I had and turn it into an affirmation in a way that, okay, maybe I wasn't mentored by, you know, some of the greats that some of my friends were mentored by, but or had like sort of the resources that I, you know, that a lot of people had, you know, as I started, you know, my creativity relatively late in life. So those things have an influence on me. So it's affirmation, letting my feelings be my feelings, but also being centered and grounded.
Within the art that you create, do you desire to create a safe space and or space for audience members of color?
Yes, I do. Well, that is my intention for many of the works, where at least there is something that either it's my presence that is there, or it is something that they're interested in, or it might be our particular subject. Or it might be, sometimes it's the people that I play with, you know, that might attract them to whatever, wherever space that I'm in. But definitely want it to be safe. And, but also I still wanted to be, make sure that I'm affirming, if, like I said before, if I'm doing the work that is sort of like an affirmation, that hopefully they'll see it as an affirmation as well. If I'm doing something different and something they find interesting, especially for younger people, maybe even some older people as well, you know, maybe they can feel like, yo, they can do it too. Or, hey, he did this, you know, why couldn't I? Because that's what, something that I would have liked to have seen. I was like 18 or 20 or something like that.
For more information, normanwlong.bandcamp.com and SoundCloud.com/Norman Long. Thank you for tuning in to Situation Fluxus, produced for and airing on WGXC 90.7 FM, a listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. I've been your host, Cheryl Kay. Tune in next Thursday at 10 a.m. for another show. I also host the Jazz Disturbance on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th Sunday of each month from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on WGXC, wgxc.org. For more information about Situation Fluxus, thejazzdisturbance@gmail.com or jazzfluxus.com. Thank you.